This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Coming up in the second half of today's show, the third installment of our series on the Minot Hospital. But we are going to start today talking about birds and conservation. Joining me in studio is Marshall Johnson. He is the Chief Conservation Officer for the National Audubon Society and the former Executive Director of the local chapter of what was then called Audubon Dakota and is now Audubon Great Plains, recently appointed to a three-year term to the North American Wetlands Conservation Council and the Neotropical Migratory Bird Conservation Act Advisory Group. Marshall, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
How much room do you have on your business card for all these titles?
I know, right? I must not be doing anything well to be doing so many things.
Oh, I don't think that's true at all, Marshall. Well, let's talk about what this newest appointment is. What is the North American Wetlands Conservation Council?
The council actually administers the North American Wetland Conservation Act grant program and a host of many other things, including overseeing or providing advisory support to the Neotropical Migratory Bird Advisory Council, which is a mouthful. But the grant program was created in the late 1980s during a period of wetland and waterfowl crises. And as you your listeners probably know, waterfowl today are one of the only suites of bird species that are actually stable or increasing, while all others are mostly declining. And more than half of our birds in North America are declining. And so the grant, the NACA, we call it NACA Council, administers a grant program which has been essential to recovering wetlands and waterfowl conservation in North America and also in Mexico as well. So since 1989, it has provided, conserved more than 31 million acres, providing $2 billion in grant funding, which has been leveraged by 3,000 partners to the tune of $4 additional billion for wetland conservation and associated habitats. So it's yes, waterfowl, but it's shorebirds, it's water quality, it's carbon sequestration. It's one of the most successful grant programs, which is really much more than a grant program in the Western Hemisphere.
So primarily your role on this council is to review these grants and decide who is getting the money for these projects?
Yes, review grants, allocate resources through a competitive process, and provide overall direction for the NACA program as well as the Neotropical Bird Migratory Advisory Group.
Well, let's talk about that balancing act of giving out grant money, because you might have 10 really great proposals, for example, that are all targeted at one specific species of bird. Mm-hmm. And I'm just making this up. But then you have other grant proposals that would maybe go after a different species or a different leg of that sustainability triangle. So can you kind of walk us through the council's mindset when it comes to deciding what types of projects most work well together?
Yeah, it's such a great question. And the NACA program has been heralded for the amount of rigor, scorned for the amount of rigor that it brings to the table. And so there is a scoring process, which is transparent, very well known, very high bar that is set. NACA projects are sort of considered the brass ring, of, if you will, of conservation grants, because the process, the requirements are so strenuous. You need one-to-one match. Typically, these grants are between $1 and $3 million for the standard grant program, and up to, I believe now, $1 million or $500,000 for the small grants program. So there's a really rigorous criteria, and that leads you to selection of projects between, obviously all of these are wetland-based or associated habitat-based projects, and having that rigorous criteria and the council staff that review these grants allows you to separate the wheat from the chaff, so to speak. But also, we take into account the bird joint ventures throughout the country, which are partnerships based on ecosystems. I sat for 10 years on the Prairie Pothole Joint Venture. And these network of joint venture, these partnerships, agencies, NGOs, state governments have been essential to reviewing these projects as well. And they provide a separate ranking for projects that are coming out of those ecosystems. So it is very competitive. It is not to pat ourselves on the back, but it's a high bar. The council has established a high standard for the quality of projects, and that criteria or that process allows us to select through a myriad of different elements and criteria the best possible projects that are going to do the most good for a suite of waterfowl, shorebirds, and other associated species.
What are the biggest threats to the specific birds that you're targeting in this project?
You know, we've lost in some landscapes more than 90% of our wetlands. And wetlands store carbon out of the atmosphere. Wetlands store, slowly purify our drinking water and recharge our groundwater and our water, our aquifers. And so that's the big driver, and it's why the North American Waterfowl Management Plan was created in 1985, the joint ventures, and then NACA as sort of the funding driver to that, because we are developing, eroding, and degrading our wetlands at an enormous pace, which has slowed down, but there's still a lot of work to be done.
We're visiting today with Marshall Johnson. He is the National Audubon Society's Chief Conservation Officer, and we are talking about birds and the importance of birds. They are known as an indicator species when it comes to things like climate change. Remind our listeners of what an indicator species is and why studying birds can really let us know what's going on with the rest of the environment.
Yeah, we like to say birds tell us. And that's meant to indicate birds need the same things that we do, clean water, clean habitats, clean air, insects. You know, all of these things. Insects provide 1 in 3 bites of food that you eat at some place has been pollinated by insects. And so we have an insect crisis. And what we tend to see with birds, whether it's a water quality issue, climate change, the collapse of insect webs and food webs, birds tell us early on that there's a problem. And birds have been studied more than just about any other species, and they're ubiquitous. They occur everywhere. They connect far-flung communities throughout the world. And so birds are, I would say, and I'm a bit biased here, they're the best indicator species for overall environmental health. And so we protect birds in many ways to protect ourselves.
A lot of what you're doing involves government policy and big NGOs and, just big players coming together. But I wonder what somebody like me who owns a very small plot of land and a house, like what can I do for helping birds?
Oh, there's so much that we can do as individuals. If you own a home, if you have a balcony, planting, making available native plants is probably one of the most important things that you can do. If you're so inclined, staying aware of the legislation, whether it's funding for conservation, policies that protect birds and the broader environment, making sure if For most people care about birds. There are 47 million active birders in the United States. The Department of Interior tracks this. And so there are a lot of people, a lot of purchasing power, aligning your purchasing decisions to what's good for the environment.
I've seen bird-friendly beef.
Absolutely. Audubon, it's a sort of a extraordinary thing that an environmental organization would endorse protein products that are associated with beef. But the research shows us that the symbiotic relationship between livestock, when managed through regenerative, sustainable methodologies, really aligns with, not perfectly, but very well and certainly better than the alternative for grassland birds, insects, honeybees, et cetera, et cetera. So purchasing decisions, policies, planting native plants in your backyard, spreading the word, staying engaged. We all have a role to play. It's really heartening in the work that we do. Birds are, as I alluded to, they're ubiquitous. They are our songstresses and troubadours in the sky. And they've been filling our lives with song. And now they're calling out to each and every one of us with their silence. And there's an important role for individuals to play in all of this.
Marshall, I mentioned that you're the former executive director of Audubon Dakota. You are now the chief conservation officer for the National Audubon Society. You've been in that role coming up on 2 years. The CEO says that you were promoted because of an innovative conservation leadership. How do you describe your style of leadership?
I'm curious. I'm curious about, I studied business at the University of Minnesota Crookston, and so I didn't study biology. And so probably frustrating at times to my staff. I am curious about everything and how things work. And I've always been looking for an opportunity to make a difference. And we all have individual skills that we bring to whatever we do. And I was fortunate enough to find that looking at things from a unique perspective was a skill that I have. And I've tried to utilize that in being an asset, a part of teams, leading teams. I think that's one of the things that I take a lot of pride in, is being able to see a problem from a different angle and rally folks to maybe non-traditional ways of thinking that have value.
People who are environmentally inclined, it's usually not a very difficult sell to say, hey, maybe replace your lawn with some pollinators or choose the bird-friendly beef or what have you. But there is often the economic angle to talking about sustainability. You're the business major. Make that argument for us.
It's a really clear and one of the most important and powerful communications and stories that we can tell as it relates to preserving habitat and whatnot. You think about wetlands, for instance, and the role that wetlands play in storing and slowly discharging rainwater and snow melt. You can either protect wetlands for a fraction of the cost or pour billions of dollars into disaster relief when there are major floods. These things are correlated, directly correlated. When we lose our wetlands on the landscape, those sponges that help manage water, we tend to have more catastrophic flooding events. And so there is a business case to be made. You protect pollinators and you have robust insect populations. You produce food in Central Valley of California and throughout other food-producing landscapes more efficiently. So you pick the issue, and there is a business economic case to be made for proactive conservation on the front end, rather than dealing with the impacts when you lose these natural systems.
That can be a really hard sell, though, because it's long-term future and fairly abstract. How do you talk to landowners? Because I know you've been instrumental in the conservation land part of this, talking to farmers, talking to ranchers. Sometimes those profit margins are a little thin. Sure. And then asking them to set aside a chunk of land and make it not producing money for them.
Yeah, this may sound a bit counterintuitive, but I learned early on that that was actually a benefit for me, not having sort of a classic natural resources background. Was that's what I was focusing on when I was coming to the ranch. I enjoyed the birds and the wildlife and the grasses and whatnot, but I was thinking and encourage my team to always think about where can we in achieving our goals, but put those on the back burner. Where can we speak to the bottom line for the rancher? And it could be we would love to see better management in a pasture or a paddock. And the impediment to that is not the rancher's willingness or desire to better manage that pasture, because if they better manage that pasture, it's going to be good for birds. It's going to produce more quality forage for the cattle, and obviously a whole stream of benefits for the environment. And oftentimes, the impediment is financial. It's the cost of that fence. It's the water infrastructure to better manage that pasture. And that's where organizations like Audubon play a critical role. That has been the backbone of our work in the Great Plains for the past 10 years. In that time, I think we provided more than $50 million in cost share, leverage, mostly to private landowners, to identify the infrastructure pinpoint, make that happen, and get better quality habitat for birds, and again, to make the bottom line work out and pin out for the landowner.
We're visiting today with Marshall Johnson, the Chief Conservation Officer for the National Audubon Society. Marshall, let's talk about the name Audubon Society. I imagine you talk about this a lot. Recently, nationally, there was discussion, should we change the name regarding John James Audubon's racist. He was unequivocally believed in white supremacy. Ultimately, the Audubon Society decided to keep the name. I notice on the website that they refer to him as a complicated and address the beautiful bird drawings and the work that he did promoting birds. But then also there's an article from J. Drew Lanham. He is a black ornithologist, and he's really grappling with someone who loves birds, as Audubon did. But again, Audubon very much racist, not just by today's standards, but even back then. Can you talk about this decision to, instead of changing the name, talking about this complicated legacy right on the website and in the magazine?
Yes, this has been one of the more difficult moments for the Audubon Society and the organization after 117 years, but a very needed period of reflection, change, and renewing and establishing commitments to being more equitable in our work, inclusive, and so that the Audubon work is, and the organization's work, people feel like they belong to it. I think this is fundamentally, regardless of what we call ourselves, people are going to remember how we show up, how we center equity, diversity, inclusion, belonging in our work, both internally and externally. And obviously for me, as an African American, the life and the racist history of John James Audubon, it obviously hits home. And there's hurt when people sort of grapple with that. And it's important to center that hurt and sit with that. And I think we are, we have, we will. And it's incumbent upon us to be, to better. Through our strategic plan, which I was honored to help facilitate as a chief conservation officer, for the first time ever, we're making commitments around what needs to happen to recover bird populations across the Western Hemisphere, and also committing in our strategic plan, which is fairly unprecedented, commitments to having a culture of excellence. And like a lot of groups and a lot of agencies right now, it's a, for me, a welcome period of change. And we are and have stumbled. We have really done incredible work in this regard. And it's important for us to continue on our journey as we move forward to becoming an organization that lives its equity, diversity, inclusion values and belonging values every day.
Are you getting blowback from local chapters or the population at large?
It's mixed. With an issue as charged as this one rightly is and should be, there are a lot of very passionate feelings about it. And the board, which owned this decision, could have gone in a different direction. The choice, given the crisis that we have in the environmental world, was to move forward, really define what Audubon and this organization means through our work and our actions. And I support that. And as the chief conservation officer, I have duties and responsibilities to ensure that we live our values through our work.
Marshall Johnson, the Chief Conservation Officer for the National Audubon Society. Thank you so much for your time today.
As always, thank you.
And we are going to continue on with birds. Here is today's episode of Bird Note called Habitat Defined.
This is Bird Note. Science conversations can sometimes be confusing. There are so many technical, jargony terms thrown around. Even science professionals can get overwhelmed and tune out. But the next time you hear the word habitat, perk up your ears a little. When you hear the word habitat, think of home. Sure, science can make habitat sound a lot more complicated, but basically, it's where a living thing, a bird, for example, prefers to live. It's that bird's natural home. For a jay that lives in the forest is its habitat, where it finds food, water, shelter, and the company of other jays. But a jay's habitat may also be your backyard or the bank parking lot down the street. If you want to understand a bird's habitat, you need to look at the world from the bird's point of view. Some birds live in different habitats at different times of year. Many sandpipers summer in the Arctic tundra, where they breed. But during the rest of the year, they live on tide flats along the coasts. From their point of view, it might be a lot like going from Kansas to Oz and back over and over. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein. Bird Note gives you the sounds of birds every day, and you can get the sights as well when you follow us on Instagram at Bird Note Radio.
Still to come on Main Street, the next installment of our series on the new hospital in Minot. But first, this news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. North Dakota motorists and their passengers will want to pay special attention to their seatbelt use starting next week. Law enforcement around the state will be conducting another Click It or Ticket campaign Monday the 22nd through June 4th.
And we're just starting to raise awareness now that the new, or I shouldn't say new, the updated seatbelt law will go into effect on August 1st.
Lauren Wallman is Safety Public Information Program Manager with the Department of Transportation. She says the change in the seatbelt law will mean drivers will now be allowed to be pulled over if the driver is not wearing a seatbelt. Currently, a driver must be stopped for another violation before being cited for not being buckled up. Wallman says the week not only provides a good time to polish up your seatbelt use habit, she says seatbelts are the best line of defense for people inside vehicles, even if you are going a short distance from home.
It's a lot of just making it a habit, you know, going down the road a couple blocks, it doesn't make it that much difference. And if you get into the habit every time you get in the vehicle, you're going to be protected when you get into that vehicle crash, if you get into a vehicle crash.
In 2022, 69% of North Dakota's motor vehicle fatalities were the result of a person not wearing a seatbelt at the time. A housing discrimination case in North Dakota dealing with occupancy standards has resulted in a settlement. Advocates say it underscores the challenges families face in maintaining stable housing when access is scarce. Mike Moan has this report.
The High Plains Fair Housing Center announced this week that Affordable Housing Developers Incorporated has agreed to pay $100,000 over a claim from a working mother from Mandan. The woman, who did not want to be publicly identified, said she was forced to vacate her townhome after updating her lease to note the recent birth of her fifth child. The Fair Housing Center's Nikki Green says the developer standards were too restrictive.
This woman and her children had a three-bedroom unit, and the max that was allowed there was five people for a household. And this was a 1,572 square foot townhome. So this was a big unit.
Green says federal recommendations allow for more flexibility and that the family situation didn't violate any city codes. As part of the settlement, leadership with the development group denies engaging in any discrimination. I'm Mike Moan.
And during National Foster Care Month this May, North Dakota HHS is recognizing family caregivers, foster care providers, and others involved in child welfare services, while also encouraging residents to join the program. Carissa Cox is a recruitment and retention specialist with the UND Children and Family Services Training Center. She says the state is facing a shortage of foster families to provide temporary homes for children.
On any given day in North Dakota, the foster care system supports about 1,400 to 1,500 children. Across the state, we currently have around 900 licensed foster care providers. There is definitely a need for foster care providers across the state. For every 10 foster homes that are licensed, roughly 9 close their license for a variety of reasons. So that need for more foster care providers across the state continues to be high and continues to be ongoing, especially for the teen population.
Cox says there is a large need for providers to serve teenagers. 24% of North Dakota children in foster care are between the ages of 13 and 18. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Josh Boche, broker and realtor with Hatch Realty, brokered by Real. Serving homebuyers and sellers in the Fargo-Moorhead Metro, Grand Forks, Bismarck, Mandan, and Detroit Lakes area. Josh can be reached at 701-369-4839 or hatchrealty.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Today we continue our tour of the new Trinity Hospital in Minot, an expansive, state-of-the-art addition to the region's healthcare system. In part three of our four-part series, we'll tour the 14 new operating room spaces, including all the new related technology. We'll also learn what services are not migrating to the new hospital in our tour with ER physician Dr. Jeffrey Sather as we cross into the new operating room suites.
So when you come across the red right here, you're actually now we're within the operating room area. So this is an area you've got to be gowned and wearing things to go into. So in this hospital, we have two catheterization labs. This is the cardiac cath lab. This is where if you had a heart attack that needed the cardiologist to go in and do an angiogram, pull out a clot, put in a stent, this is the room you would come to. You're seeing new state-of-the-art equipment in here. Nothing moved from the old hospital. Then there's a control room beside, and then there's the second lab on the opposite side, which is identical to this. This is the heart side. Over there is where you'd go if you needed thrombectomy for a stroke, for example, or some of the other IR procedures that are done, or any other one. So we have two suites like this in this facility. So then we're going to step into one of the operating rooms, and actually this is the room we are interviewing a physician that said, I've been in five of the most prestigious medical centers in the country. I've never seen an operating room like this. This particular room happens to be the open heart room. This is a dedicated operating room for cardiac surgery.
It's large.
It's huge. I don't know the dimensions or square footage of this, but it's huge. At least two of our old operating rooms would fit into this operating room. Then we'll just sneak through to the core and walk through another OR. You'll see that's huge as well. We have a total of 14 operating room spaces in this building. Two of them are shelled space. 12 are operational.
Shelled means what?
Shelled means the room's there. There's no equipment in it. So therefore, future expansion, we have 12 operating rooms that are functional. This area right here is what's called the core. This is where sterile equipment is kept. One of the unique things in this building compared to older design buildings is dirty instruments never cross paths with clean equipment. So when something's dirty, it goes into the dirty elevator. It goes down below us to the central processing unit. And it's kind of like a car wash. You come to the gross cleaning where you get any big debris off, but initial cleaning, more and more clean as you go through the whole process. And then into the area where instruments are actually sterilized. They're inspected, they're packaged in a sterile fashion. Then they go to the clean elevator to come back up to the central room here where they're stocked to be available for the operating room.
Of course, there has been a tremendous review process to clear regulatory hurdles. How's that coming along, and what have regulators been telling you?
One of the things that they, no major issues, they walk through here, and I mean, this place is a wow place. I mean, there are a couple of details to check. And when you say a lot of regulatory things, there's tons of regulatory things, lots of boxes to check in a hospital. We are a Joint Commission certified hospital. We have to meet all of their requirements. We have to meet all of the state requirements, city requirements. Everybody's got to check off and get us our occupancy, not only our occupancy in this new building, but then the licensing to say we can operate as a hospital. Important to walk through this room because this is the smallest of our OR, and it's much bigger than our biggest OR in the old hospital. So 12 functioning like this, two shelled for future expansion.
General surgeries here?
General type surgeries would go on.
Orthopedic surgeries,
yep,
et cetera.
Orthopedic surgery, general surgeries. A couple dedicated spaces, cardiovascular, cardiac surgery, and neurosurgery are more specialized type equipment in rooms. Other rooms can be, you know, equipment's portable, so it can come and go for different types of surgery. It depends on the day where you have more of one than another. Anything from orthopedic surgery to hand surgery to ocular surgery, heart surgery, neurosurgery. One thing that's unique in this hospital, which you don't see in a lot of hospitals, is we're still within the clean area of the OR, so surgeons walking out of a surgery. Imagine you're a neurosurgeon, you're doing a 10-hour surgery, and there's a small break. You get to walk away for a minute and re-scrub and come back, use the restroom, those type of things. You actually see daylight. Most operating room areas in hospitals are within the hospital somewhere, and you don't have outside windows. So you can actually look out the window and see daylight outside. You happen to be here looking over our heliport, which is about three times the size of the heliport on the old hospital, which is a piece of history that's getting shut down. That is, we believe, the first heliport built on a hospital in the United States. It was built in 1968 on that hospital.
They seem somewhat commonplace.
Now they're commonplace. But if you look at the history, if you look at the emergency medicine textbooks, for example, they talk about air transport as being something. The first successful helicopter ambulance service was at St. Anthony Central in Denver in 1972. Well, it so happens Trinity Health started the helicopter service in 1968 and built that heliport. The one caveat to that, at that point it wasn't successful. It's a service that was shut down. There was big problems back then. Think of what was going on in 1968.
Vietnam?
Vietnam War. It was hard to get pilots that could fly helicopters. It's still a usable heliport. So this is our new heliport. We also, if you look back, the poles in the backside is the edge of our property. You see the Highland poles way back there? That's the backside of our property. We have lots of open real estate for future expansion. We are going out of the operating room area into the recovery area. So if you had your surgery, you would come, they would start waking you up in the room, but you would come here to the recovery area. And you see this is just, again, a big round box of multiple spaces. There are actually some isolation rooms in this area. This area is greatly expanded from our current recovery room area in the old hospital. So this space is really nice space, and we can walk through here and we'll go into same day surgery, where if you're coming for an outpatient surgery is where you would go, the room you'd be put in. We actually have 44 same day surgery rooms. Get your surgery done, you come here to the recovery room till you're awake enough, then you'd go back to a same-day surgery room, not necessarily the same room you started out in. 44 sounds like a lot, so those rooms are constantly turning over. This is one of the areas people are amazed at how big this area is. Let's talk about what all happens here at this new campus. So 44 spaces, a lot of space. We walked by the 12 functional, total of 14 operating rooms. There's also six GI suites in the surgical platform here. There's the two cath labs. There's all of the other radiology areas where other radiology procedures are done. This is the area where patients are prepped for all of that. So 44 spaces. One of the things in medicine, when you look at this campus, we're building it for our current needs with anticipated near needs. Medicine is changing a bit. There's less inpatient things that are done. 40 years ago, when you came to the hospital, you're in the hospital a week. Now, a lot of the things that you were in the hospital a week for, like getting your gallbladder taken out, same day surgery, you go home same day. So this is more heavy. When you look at this, it's like huge for outpatient services, but not as expanded for inpatient services, because that's the trend, with ER being more of an outpatient service as well.
It's going to be hard for our listeners to contemplate how large this is.
It's hard without walking this. You can't have a clue of the size of this. As you talk about how much bigger it is, everyone that walks through is just wowed by the size. So material, when you think of materials in a hospital, right, all those disposables that are used, material supply is, it's a huge part of any hospital. The old hospital didn't have any storage in the facility itself.
Literally.
I mean, what's in the rooms mm-hmm. and the floor, but for bulk storage. So when supplies are needed, they come, they inventory all the what we call PAR rooms, where things are kept in the various units. They go back to the warehouse, which is way on the east side of town now, 4 or 5 miles from the hospital. They load it all up in the truck. They come back. They got to unload it. All of that material is brought in, gone through the process of getting unboxed, inventoried, put in a warehouse. Then when it's needed, it has to be inventoried onto a truck, and then taken to the locations needed, and then put into the storage room there. Here now we have a large warehouse within this facility. Down on the first floor. So there's loading bays for box trucks, semi-trucks to come unload. Everything's unboxed, inventoried. They got to come out of the outside container and can't go into the storage rooms with that. There's this huge process for that, but it's all within the hospital. So when something's needed on the floor, it doesn't have to be inventoried to a truck to be transported, to be unloaded, and then taken to the floor. It's simply taken on a cart up to the floor. It's a huge step for us. One, efficiency. Two, in the staff needed to do it. And three, in the readiness of the hospital to do what needs to be done. The walk we just took is the walk the surgeon would take to come and talk to the family of the patient they just operated on. And this is one of our consultation rooms. It's right off the surgical waiting area where we started out. We're essentially right back to where we started out. And so you see, these are huge rooms. Some families are big. I think you can easily put 15, 20 people in here if you had to, so the surgeon can tell the family and answer the questions once instead of mm-hmm. two or three times. Also, it's a private area for the surgeon to come in, family to come in, very private for the family and the patient.
We're enjoying our tour of the Trinity Health Hospital. It's a major state-of-the-art facility for the community of Minot and the region, visiting with Dr. Jeffrey Sather.
Just looking at the waiting area for families, I mean, it's a huge area. It's a comfortable area. Receptionists there. These are not televisions. These are surgical tracking boards. When you come for your operation, your family is given a number so they can watch the tracking board by number and know went from the...
From surgery to recovery.
Went from surgery. Now surgery's done. Went to recovery. Getting ready to go back to the room. Surgeon will be out in 5 minutes. You're going to go to consultation room 3. And the operating room teams are very good about when you're talking about some of the major surgeries that happen, heart surgeries, neurosurgeries, for example, it might be hours long. So there's tracking throughout here. And when we go up to the OB floor too, you'll see screens on the wall, patient tracking. A lot of that's all automated when patients go from place to place. Some of that tracking is for staff. Here in this waiting area, this is the public tracking area.
This isn't my grandma's hospital.
No, it's not. Not your grandma's hospital. I think we can just grab an elevator here and go right up to 3rd. And then we can look at one of the connector spaces, which are kind of nice. So if we were to walk every hallway in this building, yep. I mean every hallway, the little side hallways, you would probably put a good 6 hours, 4 to 6 hours into just doing it once. The board doesn't talk about how are we competing with Sanford or how are we competing with CHI. We talk about what's the need mm-hmm. for our region. Okay. That we're committed to serve. And Trinity is committed to serve its designated region, which has been identified from Cavalier County into Montana and essentially north of the lake.
Does Trinity have other regions in the country?
No, we are a locally governed, nonprofit healthcare organization. We are governed by a local board of directors. All of our board of directors are community members here. There's myself and one other physician on the board. Then there's business owners. We have some local senators on the board, CEOs of other organizations in the community on our board. Everybody on the board has an area of specialty or expertise. that board then sets the vision, the strategy, along with the administrative team, organization, and then the administrative team does the business of getting things done. Trinity Health is focused, all of our employees are focused on meeting the needs of our community, which is that greater region. It's Minot and the greater Northwest region of North Dakota and Northeastern Montana that we serve.
Do the needs of this region differ than perhaps needs in other parts of the state or the region?
The basic needs are the same. Mm-hmm. We are the only hospital, large hospital within this region. We partner with 11 critical access hospitals in the region. They do primary care, basic mm-hmm. hospitalization things. Anything specialized comes here. So we're the referral center for the region. We're the trauma center for the region. We're the cardiac center for the region. We're the neurosurgical center for the region. So all of those specialty things come here. We have a vision of what's for the future. And you look at this and this is wow. And you say, is this it? Is this good for the next 100 years? No. When you look at our property, we're here where we have lots of property for a reason. We have a state-of-the-art cancer center downtown. Millions of dollars have been put into that. But 10 years down the road, 15 years down the road, whatever that time frame is, that might not be state-of-the-art and that space may no longer be adequate. Now we have space here that we potentially could build a new cancer center on this site. Our psychiatric services will remain at our St. Joe's campus. Our St. Joe's campus downtown will stay open. In the future, could we have a new psychiatric hospital out on this property? So I think the answer to that question is we built this campus to meet our immediate need mm-hmm. and what we saw as need for the foreseeable near future with lots of room for the farther future as things change.
That was emergency room physician and former chief of staff, Dr. Jeffrey Sather, at the recently opened new Trinity Hospital in Minot. Dr. Sather will continue providing us a tour Friday when we'll tour the new OB floor. It's the most needed addition to the hospital. We'll have more Main Street next.
Support is provided by Drs. Kirk Coyer and Phil Sondrel of Urgent Med, providing personalized walk-in medical care for all ages 7 days a week in South Fargo. Urgent Med, where urgent care doesn't feel like urgent care.
Next time on The Pulse, when Chris Lundy was a kid, he suddenly developed a terrible cough.
And it was intense.
When doctors couldn't figure out what was wrong with Chris, his mother took him to see a healer.
It was dark. It was all candles. What happened when I was there? What went down?
The quest to understand a treatment deeply rooted in cultural traditions.
That's The Pulse, coming up at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and as we are closing out the school year, teachers won't be headed to the Teacher's Lounge anymore. Unless, of course, it is the old school center and teacher's lounge in Fortuna, North Dakota. We learn all about that in this excerpt from the Great American Folk Show, hosted by Tom Brosseau.
When people come in, they just want to know, how did you end up here? Especially when they find out that I'm originally from right outside of Detroit, and then I've lived in Tucson for the last 25 years. And how does somebody from two large metropolises end up in a town of 30 people? And so it is an interesting story.
That's Mike Ferris. He and his wife Deborah run the Old School Center. It's a hotel, RV park, and store in Fortuna, North Dakota, with a restaurant and bar called the Teacher's Lounge. Quite a gathering spot for such a small community. Fortuna is way out west in North Dakota, in Divide County. That's in the upper left-hand corner of the state.
We're construction people. When everything tanked in the 08 bursting bubble, we had to find some place to go and work. And we had worked for a couple of years, but about 10, it was going to be over. And we actually were going to move to Texas. Everybody moved to Texas. So there was not nearly the demand for gravel, and that's what we were really big in at the time, was the gravel crushing. So we came up here and literally planned on staying for the summer, crushing and screening gravel, putting up a bunch of gravel, maybe staying the winter and the rest of the next summer, and then going home for sure. And we'll be here 10 years.
So that's how Mike got to Fortuna, North Dakota, basically a construction job. But then what possessed him to want to stay and open up a restaurant and hotel in a town of 30? Well, it doesn't boil down just to this, but he started thinking to himself, okay, what else can I do here to keep myself occupied? Because there's lots of free time during the North Dakota winters. Days, weeks, months. So Mike notices an old, dilapidated building on the main stretch of road going right through town. And at one point, it was a school. So he approaches the owner of it and inquires if it's for sale.
He had bought it from the city, and he had a body shop in the old gymnasium, and that was it. There was nothing in the whole rest of the school. The roof was caving in. There was water running into every room. Windows were busted out. I mean, it was about to fall in. People now that I've been here tell me they used to drive by and say, 2 or 3 more years, that won't be there. It'll fall in. What they didn't know was that the structure was so good on it. They built this so well in 1964. Well, it opened in 1964, the rebuild of it. We bought it. We didn't know what we were going to do with it. And we started asking, what do you think we should open here? And people said, a convenience store, a store, a store. That was the number one thing, a store, a bar, showers. So we ended up opening the store and pay showers February 1st, 2014. July 4th of the same year, we opened everything else, the bar, the restaurant, the motel, and the RV park.
How many people can stay at the motel?
It started out, it was a 16-room motel, but then we made a couple of suites and took 2 rooms. So now we have 14. We have a suite, then we have 2 single rooms with bathrooms, and then the rest of them are dorm style. The restrooms and the showers are in the hallway. You know, the oil field gets a bad rap a lot of times. There is some bad that comes and goes with it because you're getting people from all over the country. But for the most part, the people that we encountered were so appreciative that there was something here, a facility for them, hot showers, that kind of thing.
A store.
They would do any. I mean, they were so nice. They'd come in and shovel your walks for you while your coffee was brewing or something. They wanted this place open. And then the locals followed suit. And we always laugh. When you first came in, we're talking about the population up here probably being a lot of Norwegian, and it is. So they accept me here, and that's not an easy thing to have happen, because in North Dakota, if you're not from North Dakota, you're not from North Dakota, period. And once in a while, they allow a transplant. Well, they allowed me and my wife, and it's so funny. It's because I'm like them. I mean, I come from Michigan, a small town in Michigan originally. I grew up like this, and I identified with them. So, ha-ha, all that said and done, I have a DNA test done not too long ago, and I'm 7% Norwegian.
You're accepted, and you can prove it.
Yes, yes, I actually am family.
Well, thank you so much, Mike. This is Mike Ferris. He's speaking to us. We're in Fortuna, North Dakota, at his establishment, the Teacher's Lounge. It was really nice to sit down and have a chat with you today.
Well, we sure appreciate
it. Let's do it again sometime.
Definitely, for sure. Thank you.
Mike Ferris and his wife, Deborah Lamb, run the Old School Center in Fortuna, North Dakota. It's a hotel, RV park, bar, and grill. Perfect place to stop and unwind for a little bit. Thank you, Mike Ferris, for being on the show. More information about the Old School Center can be found by visiting theoldschoolcenter.com.
The Great American Folk Show airs Saturdays at 5 o'clock Central right here on Prairie Public. Dakota Datebook is next. Though the time we live
is small, love is one. Hi, I'm Tom Brusso. On the next Great American Folk Show, Texas legend Jimmy Dale Gilmore joins us to pay tribute to late Minot, North Dakota singer-songwriter and collaborator Bill Gessner.
He had this great, expansive love for the world, for everybody.
Plus Charleston, South Carolina's first poet laureate, Marcus Amaker, and musicians John Wood and Eden Parker. And if you're looking for a filthy double shot in Fargo, head not to a bar, but an underground roving venue called Namaste Chai.
So real chai is not what people in America think chai is.
The Great American Folk Show, Saturday at 5 p.m. Central on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for May 18th. The Reverend Eben Saunders of Fargo was not only a minister, but a well-regarded historian of the Red River Valley. In 1918, from May to June, the Reverend Saunders wrote a column in the Fargo Forum in which he wrote brief biographies of North Dakota pioneers. On this date, he he wrote about Civil War veteran Aaron Chandler, who arrived in North Dakota in 1881. Chandler, a native of Ohio, homesteaded in Cass County. While the brief biography is interesting, a tragic tale is inferred in the line that reads, "He was grandfather of the late Edgar Roy Chandler, who made the supreme sacrifice, in action, May 9, 1918. Edgar Roy had died fighting in World War I only 9 days before the column about his grandfather appeared in the paper. Edgar Roy Chandler was born in 1894 at the family farm near Gardner, North Dakota. He went by his middle name, Roy. The family moved to Fargo, and Roy attended the high school at the North Dakota Agricultural College. In July of 1917, Roy joined the 164th Infantry, and he sailed to France that December. Roy wrote his last letter to his mother on April 10, 1918. He told his mother he had become a sniper, writing, "I've been in action against the Boche. I was out in no man's land once, and I know how to keep my head low when the shells start to fly." His mother believed he was probably in no man's land when he died on May 9th. Roy was the first soldier from Fargo to die in World War I. He was buried in the Somme American Cemetery in France, and his name is included on the All Veterans Memorial in Bismarck. A memorial service was held for Roy in Fargo on May 25th, 1918. 1 year later, a ceremony was held at the North Dakota Agricultural College to honor the 12 alumni and students who died in the war. Trees were planted near the campus gates and the chemistry building to honor the 12 men. 102 years later, a woman in Phoenix, Arizona, was going through her late husband's possessions when she found a letter written by his Uncle Roy. It was that last letter to Roy's mother, along with a telegram announcing his death. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Trista Razor Sturza. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding by Humanities North Dakota, North Dakota's largest lifelong learning community.
Kennedy Ryan writes romances grounded in issues such as indigenous rights or climate justice. How indignation spurs her storytelling on the next morning edition from NPR News.
That's it for this Thursday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, more on the Trinity Hospital in Minot. This time, revisit the OB floor to learn about the changes there that will impact women's health. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.